KPR News, I'm Mitch Wertlieb.
Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. It appears that the leadership of the U.S. House is in chaos. House Speaker John Boehner is resigning at the end of this month, and it's not clear who his successor will be. That's because Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy suddenly dropped out of the race yesterday afternoon to replace Boehner, and no candidate has emerged to win the strong support of the House Republican caucus. Will this situation increase the partisan gridlock in Congress, or could it lead to more bipartisan cooperation? These are some of the questions we have for our guest today, Congressman Peter Welch. Congressman, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thank you.
And you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. What do you make of this leadership fight in the House Republican caucus in Washington? Does it really make any difference to the outcome of key issues? Has the time come for Congress to consider some new gun control legislation in light of the shootings that have taken place across the country? And there was another one this morning in northern Arizona. Does the United States have a military role to play in Syria? And what should be done about the enormous number of refugees who are pouring into Europe? Your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. There may be another issue that you would like to discuss with Congressman Peter Welch. You can send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net or give us a call. 1-800-639-2211. Congressman, House Speaker John Boehner shocked the political world last month when he announced that he would be resigning from Congress in the beginning of November. Now the apparent successor to Boehner, House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, has pulled out of the race for Speaker. You've got a bunch of friends within the House Republican caucus. Explain to us what is going on.
Well, in fact, it's very, very serious. There is an existential crisis within the Republican Conference. Speaker Boehner was toppled, and why? It was because he was committed to the integrity, in my view, of the institution and was not going to allow there to be a government shutdown over Planned Parenthood funding. So he made a decision to avoid that, but he knew that was going to mean that he wouldn't be able to continue as Speaker, so he resigned. Then you had Mr. McCarthy, who was the likely successor and is broadly supported within the Republican Party. And what happened with him is that the talk radio folks started going back home in a lot of the districts of my colleagues, calling him McBoehner, and basically making it clear to Kevin McCarthy that he was going to win in the Republican conference. But when it came to getting the votes on the floor, there was going to be a defection by at least 40 or so Republicans who have totally embraced the tactics of shutdown and default on our debt ceiling in order to get their way. So what we've got is a situation where the governing majority is split, and there's an existential decision that my Republican colleagues have to make. Do they want governing or do they want gridlock? And essentially, they've been trying to have it both ways in a way. Mr. Boehner was doing his best to bring that Freedom Caucus, I would call the folks who've adopted tactics that I think are extreme, that is shut down in default. It's not about their conservative policies. There's plenty of room for debate on them. But if you have a legislative body where the majority has a group that is going to insist on shutting down the entire government unless they get their way on whatever the issue of the moment is, you can't govern, and it leads to gridlock. So my view here is that the challenge for the Republicans is to have an agreement within their conference that they're going to govern. And that's much more important than who the person is, because whether it's Paul Ryan or some people are talking about an outside person to come in, if that individual is leading a conference that continues to be split and you've got that group that has veto power to shut down government whenever they don't get their way, will continue basically to drift the way we are. Now, I have heard some Republicans say that they think there should almost be a coalition or cooperation with Democrats, and I like that idea. You know, some of my colleagues think we ought to just stand aside and watch the Republicans have this fight. But bottom line, I think it's really important that we get this place operating because we need a transportation bill, we need a budget, we should be debating gun issues. You know, that we haven't had any debate on any of these issues. So if there is a Republican majority that proposes someone who's committed to governing and basically says, look, we're not going to be doing the shutdown approach and the debt ceiling default approach, then I think Democrats should reach out and cooperate. We're the minority. We can be a constructive and cooperative minority. The thing I think we're entitled to ask is the same thing that I think Americans are entitled to ask. We want a majority that's prepared to govern.
So there's a lot of talk today that a lot of pressure is being put on Paul Ryan, who currently is the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, to get Paul Ryan to agree to run for Speaker. A, do you think he will? He's indicated so far that he really doesn't want to be Speaker, but that was before this whole chaotic situation happened. So do you think that he will reconsider and run for Speaker? And B, if he does he fit your criteria of trying to avoid a government shutdown?
Well, first of all, Paul Ryan is probably someone who could get the votes of the full conference. He's widely respected on his side and a lot of respect on my side. So I think he could. I'd be surprised if he did. He's got the job that he really likes, the chair of the Ways and Means Committee, which is a policy-oriented job. The speaker's job is a political job. Secondly, whether it's Paul Ryan or not, I think he'd enjoy a honeymoon for a period of time. But if, in fact, the Republican majority continues to give veto power to that that group of about 40, rather than work with Democrats who want to find common ground, then Paul Ryan, I think, would face the same fate. It would take a while, but I think he'd be looking at the same outcome as Speaker Boehner and Majority Leader McCarthy.
So how do you see this situation playing out in the next week or two?
Well, you know, there's a very simple way to resolve this. And that is to go back to the good old-fashioned compromise and cooperation. You know, there's a lot of Republicans who are really upset about what's going on. They think it's bad for their party, but more importantly, they know it's bad for the country. And a lot on our side, the Democrats understand that as well. I mean, we are now in a legislative body that doesn't legislate. And that would be like VPR, a news organization, not reporting news. I mean, this is just not acceptable. And the reason we're not legislating is that there is a group here that's been empowered and emboldened, and it is on the Republican side, that feels entitled to shut the government down and default on our obligations if they don't get their way. They've got to cut the cord. That wing of the party just has to be cleaved away and not appeased. And that's the simple decision, gut-wrenching as it may be on the Republican side, because a lot of those members have a lot of support back in their districts, including from talk radio. Now, my view on the Democratic side is that we've got to indicate a willingness to work with Republicans and a potential Republican leader who's committed to governing. And governing, to me, would mean on these major issues where we know the country has to move forward, a transportation bill, the export-import bank, the gun issues, that we should put legislation on the floor, and each of us should be required to vote yes or no, and then our constituents know where we stand. And I also think it means that they've got to acknowledge that resort to this nuclear button tactic of shutting the government down, whether it's about Obamacare or it's about Planned Parenthood, is just not a legitimate tactic. It's one that's, A, doomed to failure. It doesn't get through the Senate. It would get vetoed. Number two, it does real damage to this country and to taxpayers. And there's an irony here because a lot of the folks who are employing this tactic claim to be fiscal conservatives. But the last time we had a government shutdown, it cost taxpayers $24 billion. I mean, that's absolutely outrageous. So we've got to solve this problem.
Do you think the chances of a government shutdown have increased because of the activities of the last couple of weeks?
They have increased somewhat. Because you had Speaker Boehner, who avoided the shutdown at the cost of his speakership, and I admire him. He's a stand-up person. You had Majority Leader McCarthy, who clearly did not want to use shutdown as a tactic, but he was defeated. So now we're in this limbo period, and this is an extraordinary thing to have a congressional majority of 248 members of a majority party that can't agree on a leader. And that's where I get back to the danger of bringing this institution down. You know, there's a debate that is going on now that I never saw in Vermont. Remember, when I first went to the state Senate, Republicans were in charge. And they were for small government, low taxes in small government. But they believed in personal responsibility, and they really believed in institutions. They thought all of us had some personal responsibility to make institutions be the custodians of values we all cared about. So it might be the local bank, or it might be the General Assembly. That very commitment to institutions is being challenged here by some folks who think if you tear it down, it's no problem. And that is wrong. I mean, we all have our failures and we all have our limitations, but we all need to make some commitment to try to build something up for the future. And that can be the local volunteer fire department, or it can be the House of Representatives.
We got this interesting email from Craig, who writes, "What is needed is to reform how the speaker is elected and the role of the speaker. The Westminster model is superior, where once elected, that person becomes neutral. And by the way," Craig writes us, "the speaker does not need to be a representative." Is that true?
Well, it is true. We could vote for somebody outside of the House of Representatives to serve as speaker. In fact, one of my colleagues voted for Colin Powell last time. But as much as the reason I disagree with that comment is that at this time, the challenge we face is not going to be solved by an individual who occupies the chair of speaker. John Boehner was a fair-minded individual who cared about the institution, but he was in a party where the party did not make a decision about saying no to the wing of the party that was always willing to shut the government down if they didn't get their way. The other option for the Republicans, who are the majority, is to cast those guys overboard and come to some Democrats like me who are willing to work with them. And in fact, Boehner did that a few times to avert a shutdown. And like, the Democrats really voted to keep the lights on when the Planned Parenthood threat was out there, and a number of Republicans did as well. But most of them voted for the shutdown. Boehner put the country first. So the party has to put the country first.
Today in the program, our guest is Congressman Peter Welch. Our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. If you've got a question or a comment for the congressman, let's talk to Rick in South Burlington. Hey, Rick, welcome to the program.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Quick question that relates to appropriate representation of citizens by our government. And I'm sure you're probably familiar with the recent Princeton researcher, Martin Gillens, whose conclusions and book essentially look at government policy and compare it to people's preference. And his conclusion is that for the past several decades, whenever the preferences on policy of the 90% of all Americans differ from the preferences of the richest top 10%, everything in policy-wise done by our Washington government for recent decades shows zero correlation, statistically insignificant correlation with following the preferences of the 90% of us. And the second part of the question is, at the moment, if I'm right, I think I am, when you send out a questionnaire to your constituents asking for our opinions on issues, you do not include any question that would remotely allow us to give an opinion on this particular subject. And for that matter, neither does Patrick Leahy or even Bernie, and neither does the Democratic Party.
So Rick, let me just step in here. I mean, is the question that you're asking that big money is totally dominating our political system?
It goes to representation rather than money, Bob.
Okay. Congressman Welch, what do you think?
Well, I'm not quite, first of all, on the big money, it's unbelievably bad. Ever since Citizens United, the spigots have opened. I mean, you just look at the presidential candidates. with the exception of Bernie. You know, Bernie's getting small money, small donors. He's almost, I think, over 600,000 donors. But everybody else is being fueled by super PACs. And what's happened is that the big money, the folks who have a huge amount of money, are able basically to fund the campaigns of these various candidates who are out there. So Citizens United is a disastrous decision, and it's got to be reversed. It's either got to be reversed through legislation or a constitutional amendment, and I support both, or a new decision by the Supreme Court. But the big money really does make a difference, and it's turning people off and making them very cynical. On the other part of that, I try to solicit as much information as I can. I have Congress in your community events that are very small, and people can come in and talk to me at great length, and they're really instructive for me. And we've got our Facebook page and our and in fact, yesterday when I was at the VW hearing, a lot of the questions that I asked, I presented, were ones that Vermonters sent to me on Facebook. So I do my best, and I think Bernie and Patrick do as well, and not to say that we couldn't do better.
You know, you mentioned Bernie Sanders. We'd gotten a couple of emails wondering why you're not supporting and endorsing Senator Sanders in the Democratic presidential race. Why are you on the sidelines?
There's two reasons. The first is this presidential candidate, this campaign is incredibly important in my view that the Democratic candidate win. And I think that in order for that candidate to win, it's got to be much more the candidate connecting with the voters rather than with the superdelegates. The second is, as a superdelegate, I have some leverage at the appropriate time to try to help make certain that we're in the best chance to win. So that's my reason for not endorsing. I actually think it's incidental what the superdelegates say and who they endorse. It's much more important that the candidates get the support of the grassroots, and Bernie obviously has been doing that, and Hillary is working to do it. So we've got a very vigorous campaign, and I'm looking forward to the debate on Tuesday night.
There's a lot of speculation that Vice President Joe Biden might get into this race. Do you think it would be good for the process to have Biden in this race?
I do. Yeah, I do. I think Vice President Biden has run for president twice before. I think in my mind, he clearly would like to. Obviously, he's got personal challenges that he has to face with the death of his really beloved son. But if you have three really solid candidates, and that's really how I would see it, you've got Bernie and Hillary right now, and Biden would obviously be in the first tier. And I think all of them have certain political and personal strengths that would give us a pretty significant choice.
Today on the program, our guest is Congressman Peter Welch. Right after our break, we're going to be talking about some gun control legislation. Your thoughts on that issue or anything else pending before Congress? 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today, Congressman Peter Welch. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. Congressman, yesterday a group of roughly two dozen Democrats unveiled a new gun control bill. It does several things. It strengthens current background check requirements. It requires background checks for all gun sales, including online sales and the sale of guns by private individuals at gun shows. It makes gun trafficking a federal crime. Do you support this approach?
Yes, I do. We've got in Vermont, we're lucky in Vermont that we've got such a solid tradition of responsible gun use. But the country's just seen one tragedy after another. I mean, Navy Yard, Newtown, Aurora, Virginia Tech, Columbine, and, of course, just recently, Roseburg, Oregon. And these all happened where individuals had guns, and these were people that shouldn't have them. And it's very discouraging in Congress where each time that happens, the representatives from that state stand up and ask for a moment of silence, which obviously is heartfelt, but then Congress does nothing. So, in fact, I think there's room to respect the Second Amendment, but also have common sense, a gun legislation where we really take steps to try to keep guns away from people who just flat out shouldn't have them. So the background check legislation is important, and getting rid of the gun show loophole is important. And you can do that in a way where you don't get in the way of inter-family transfers or, selling or giving your gun to one of your hunting buddies. So this can be done where the focus is really trying to keep guns away from people that we would all agree simply should not have them. I also think we've got to take a look at the domestic violence issue. You know, women who are in relationships where they're getting abused, if that person has a gun, the statistics show that there's 12 times the likelihood that there'll be a serious injury or death. So domestic violence, whether it's a married partner or just a domestic partner, I think we've really got to take some action there. And then finally, that straw purchasing, that's something Senator Leahy, of course, has been championing, where somebody who's legally entitled to get a gun does and then gives it or sells it to somebody who's not legally entitled to get it. And that's just a purchaser acting as a front man to violate the law. And I think we've got to crack down on that. So, yes, I do support those steps.
Congressman, some people might be wondering, though, that if this bill had been in place over the past few years, would it have prevented any of the gun violence and mass killings that have taken place in this country?
You know, here's the truth. None of us really know whether a law, in fact, we do know that any law doesn't necessarily stop what is prohibited in that law from happening. And that's true with the person who shouldn't have a gun getting a gun, especially with all the guns that are here in the country. But does that really answer the question of whether, as a public policy, we should be taking common sense steps to do our best to keep guns away from mentally ill people, like that man who just shot those students at the community college in Oregon? So, you know, that argument has some merit. It has some truth to it. You pass a law, that doesn't mean what the law says will be complied with, but it doesn't mean that there isn't a serious problem. And I do believe that people who are mentally ill, people who are criminals, people who are domestic abusers, they shouldn't have guns.
So we've gotten some emails on this, Congressman Welch, from some folks who think that the legislation as just described violates the Second Amendment rights of many Americans and violates the Vermont Constitution. What do you say to that?
Well, I believe that you can have the Second Amendment in some reasonable common sense provisions to try to keep guns away from mentally ill people. It coexists. You know, we do have a tradition in Vermont, a very proud tradition of responsible gun use. And we also have a proud tradition of families going hunting together, learning about nature, bonding, being and actually I've seen so many parents spend a lot of time teaching their children who like to be outdoors, like to learn about nature, like to hunt, the importance of extremely responsible gun use. And that's to be honored. Those are good people doing good things with their family. And the question is, can you honor that, respect that, but also say, look, these mentally ill people, like out in Oregon, can we take some steps that diminish their ability so easily to get access to a gun without compromising the Second Amendment rights of the law-abiding citizens who are the vast majority? I happen to think we can.
We got this email from Michael who wrote, President Obama is again exploring executive action on gun control. One of his last executive actions prohibits the re-importation of surplus military firearms. This stopped a Vermont company from importing a quantity of collectible World War II firearms and contributed to said company laying off 41 employees. Do you support the president in taking executive actions such as this?
I don't know the details on that. I mean, whenever there is a use of executive authority, whether it's related to guns, whether it's related to the environment, the president has limited authority on what the president can do. And if the president exceeds that authority, that's where the check and balance of the judicial system would have him step back. I'm not familiar with the specific details of this. Obviously, if there are layoffs as a result of an executive action, that's a real concern to me. Generally, I find that you can achieve your goal in a way that allows for the legitimate meritorious aspects of whatever that policy is to be honored. But I don't know enough about the specifics on this to be able to give more of an answer than that.
Today on the program, our guest, Congressman Peter Welch. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Gregory in Burlington. Hi, Gregory. What's on your mind?
Yes, thanks. I and many other people believe that gerrymandering is at the root of a lot of the problems that we've been having. Is it so entrenched that nothing can be done about fixing the gerrymandering problem, or is that something that we could concentrate on?
Well, first of all, I agree with you. Gerrymandering, for people who don't know what that is the state legislatures define the districts they define the congressional districts. And by and large, both parties, it's gotten worse lately, have designed districts for the benefit of whoever the majority party is. And in fact, those districts are getting so gerrymandered that they're either really, really liberal or they're really, really super conservative. And it is a huge problem. And the reason it is a lot of my colleagues, my Republican colleagues, who are very reasonable people, will say to me, and this happened in the Boehner election. You know, they were going to have to vote on whether to dump Boehner. They supported Boehner, but they were getting hammered at home in these extremely conservative districts to vote against Boehner, and they were fearful that if they didn't vote against him, they would be primaried. And of course, it happened with Eric Cantor. He was not quote conservative enough on immigration, and Eric Cantor was plenty conservative on immigration. So what it does with these gerrymandered districts, and this is, I think, the heart of your point, is that it really diminishes the capacity of members to compromise, to reach across the aisle, to find common ground, and get us to yes. So I would like us to eliminate gerrymandering and am a sponsor of legislation that would have impartial commissions writing the congressional districts, and they would be doing that in each state. We have it in Iowa, we have it in California, and it's really been beneficial in both of those places. The races are more competitive. The people who get elected have to speak to a cross-section of the voters that they represent, not just that narrow branch. So I don't think we have much of a chance in this Congress to get that passed, but I think it would really be good for the country if we diminish the power of gerrymandering. And I see that as almost significant as getting rid of big money in politics. So thank you for that question.
Congressman, let's take a look at the situation in Syria. You've got a military crisis. You've got a refugee crisis taking place there and in other parts of the Middle East. Essentially, I think you've got the government of President Assad trying to cling to power. You've got the forces of ISIS in the region, and Assad says he's trying to defeat this terrorist group. You've also got rebels who are fighting the Assad regime because this government has killed hundreds of thousands of Syrian people who've been opposed to the Assad government. Now you've got the Russians bombing sites of ISIS and the rebel forces as a way to prop up Assad. What do you think the United States should do here?
Well, you kind of outlined what is an incredible mess. That was a really good outline. Here's, I think, the reality. That is a situation that is very chaotic and doesn't lend itself to a one-size-fits-all approach. Assad's got to go, but that can't be the major objective of our policy. And the reason is not out of any concern for Assad. He's been killing his own people. But Assad is representative of a significant element in Syria, the Alawites and the Christians, who, if Assad were gone tomorrow and there was a vacuum created, those people would be slaughtered. And the likelihood, the greatest likelihood, is that you'd have an al-Nusra or ISIS government, which would be obviously the worst of all worlds. So the ideal here, and this is what Secretary Kerry, I think, is attempting to do, is you really need a P5 plus one kind of approach. That's what we used in the negotiations with Iran about the nuclear deal, where you're getting all the players involved. And it would have to include Russia. It would have to include our European allies. And it would have to include the Gulf states, where there would be an effort to try to plan for a transition away from Assad, but where there would be the potential for some stability and not a bloodbath with the Alawites and the Christians. Right now, it's a chaotic situation with the Russians propping up Assad, but that doesn't necessarily mean Assad would have to be there forever. We've got to find a way diplomatically to get people to the table and provide for a transition government.
Do you think the United States has done enough to provide military equipment to the rebels who are fighting Assad?
Well, see, I have appreciated the president's restraint here because there's a premise behind the question of whether we've given, quote, enough money to the or enough arms to the rebels. And that premise is that we could identify, quote, the good rebels, and number two, we could be confident that the arms we gave them would stay within their hands. And if anybody has noticed in some of these horrible scenes of ISIS celebrating victories, they're driving U.S. equipment. So it's an easier said than done strategy. And in fact, you know, there was a lot of pressure on the president, and he ultimately agreed to this, to, quote, train rebels, the good rebels in Syria. I was against that, and I wasn't against it on practical grounds, not on ideological grounds. And my practical grounds were that I had no confidence we would be able to vet and define who these rebels are. And, of course, it turns out that we spent $500 million in that program in a total of five, quote, good rebels are now in Syria fighting on our behalf. So there's a mess there that is not something we created, and we've got to do our best to manage. But that conflict between the Sunni and the Shia, and ISIS, of course, is the Sunni fighters, they have oxygen to do their terrible things where there continues to be sectarian conflict as there was and continues to be in Iraq and in Syria.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Bill, who is calling from Brunswick, New York. Hey, Bill, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And hello. Thank you for taking my call. Being a New Yorker, and I've followed your career closely, Congressman, and I'm very impressed. I wanted to ask you about a group that you've been associated with, No Labels.
Right.
I visited your office in Washington about 3 years ago and spoke with your staff about No Labels, and my understanding is that since that time you've joined the organization and adhered to its principles of reaching across the aisle and trying to come up with the yes in votes. I wonder if you might just talk a little bit about No Labels and how you think the organization is doing.
Well, I think the organization is doing good. It does two things, okay? One is that within Congress, those of us who've joined that, Republicans and Democrats in about equal numbers, about 40 and 40, we all share the common objective that we've got to make this Congress work. And that's the aspect of it that is important to me. You know, I do every chance I get to work with a colleague, particularly a Republican colleague, because we just can't afford this gridlock, I take it. And No Labels has a bunch of my Republican colleagues that want to work with Democrats. I've worked with them on a number of pieces of legislation, particularly in energy efficiency and government efficiency. But I do other things in that effort. I just came back from West Virginia, where I went to a coal mine with David McKinley, a Republican member of Congress. He and I disagree about climate change, but he and I both agree that these coal miners, they've kept the lights on for our country, and they didn't cause climate change. In my view, those of us who are vigorous about wanting climate change initiatives, we have to help those coal miners deal with the dislocation that's occurring. Now, it's not just the EPA, it's natural gas, it's market forces. But anytime I have an opportunity to work with a Republican or a Democrat on something where we agree, I try to focus on that common ground. And that's really the underlying approach of No Labels. So I value that. They're also their own organization outside where they're really encouraging the presidential candidates to adopt a strategic plan, which makes a lot of sense about trying to get our budget balanced by 2030, about having a transportation fund, creating 25 million jobs, and making Social Security and Medicare solvent for 75 years. So those are good objectives.
Congressman, we just got a couple of minutes left, but yesterday, as a member of the House Oversight Committee, you questioned Michael Horn, the president of Volkswagen America, about the company's efforts. They deliberately presented false emission information regarding some of their diesel-powered cars. There are thousands of lawsuits that consumers have filed over this case. What role does Congress have to oversee this situation?
Well, I think we started it by just drawing further attention to it and expressing our outrage. You know, I asked on my Facebook page Vermonters to give me suggestions on questions, and I was just amazed at how angry people were legitimately about the just bold and brazen deception by VW, claiming that it was a clean diesel when it was anything but. And a lot of folks in Vermont bought these cars because they liked the car, but they liked the green advertising. They liked thinking that they were doing something good with this high mileage. So that deception, is what one Vermonter said, and I used it at the hearing, makes VW as the Lance Armstrong a liar of the car industry. So I think we've got to keep the pressure on. But now VW, I think, is really on the run. And bottom line, I want to find out who, what, why, when, and how this happened.
We've got about 30 seconds. Do you think Congress can prevent VW from writing off any settlement expenses?
I sure hope so. You know, we just had a $18 billion settlement or so with BP, and the taxpayers had to foot half that bill. I'm really outraged by that. And I asked the head of VW, and he didn't give me a direct answer, but he did agree with me that it should be VW, not the taxpayers, to pay any settlement. So that was the point of my question. I wanted to get him on the record. I want to focus attention on that. But that is just such a ripoff if taxpayers are footing part of the bill.
Congressman Peter Welch, many thanks for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you.
Coming up next, I'll talk with Emma Mulvaney-Stanek, who is the chairperson of the Vermont Progressive Party, about the 2016 gubernatorial race. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. It's been a busy week for some of Vermont's gubernatorial candidates. On Monday, former state senator Matt Dunn formally kicked off his campaign to win the Democratic nomination. And then on Tuesday afternoon, former Transportation Secretary Sue Minter officially launched her campaign. There are now three announced Democratic candidates, Dunn, Minter, and House Speaker Shap Smith. And two Republican candidates are definitely running, Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott and businessman Bruce Lissman. Will there be a progressive candidate in this race, or will the Progressive Party decide to informally support one of the Democratic candidates? These are some of the questions we have for our guest today, Emma Mulvaney-Stanek, who is the chairperson of the Vermont Progressive Party. Emma, it's great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
So for the past three gubernatorial elections, the progressives did not run a candidate against Democrat Peter Shumlin because he supported a number of your key priorities, but things seem to have changed. Last December, Shumlin dropped a plan to implement a single-payer, government-financed healthcare system, a top priority for the progressives. This past winter, he got into some big budget battles with the Vermont State Employees Association. So on a number of key issues, would it be fair to say that you think that Peter Shumlin has let the progressives down?
Yes. I don't think there's a way to splice those words. I really think that people are quite disappointed in Democratic leadership in general, Governor Shumlin, but also the House leadership in the Vermont legislature. We have not seen Democrats standing up on economic justice issues, and that is a core value and factor for progressives.
And what are some of the key issues that you feel these Democratic candidates and leaders in the Democratic Party have not addressed?
Well, one core issue is around the theme of working people. So we saw the attacks on public sector workers and state government. We saw continued reductions in all those state services. And it's a chronic debate around the state budget. And so there's always attacks. And it's always, the Democrats have been in leadership for the last several cycles. So that's a constant theme. Another is just looking at working people's issues, like doing a meaningful increase to the minimum wage. That we didn't see. We saw an incremental increase to the state minimum wage. We have long known that livable wages and the livable wage number for the state of Vermont is nowhere near where the minimum wage is. So that would be another issue. And as you mentioned before, single-payer health care. We've been having this debate for a really long time. And I think progressives 6 to 8 years ago really thought that maybe the Democrats would stick to their word and become a leader on this issue. Vermont, of all places in the country, could figure something out. And we were on that path. And then we took a hard right and we completely, you know, went off the path last December. And it was a great disappointment to Progressive Party members. And that all feeds into what how we're looking at 2016 and looking at the governor's race, lieutenant governor's race, and really questioning people need better alternatives. Democrats have just not been following through on what really working Vermonters really need.
So you've got three Democrats in the race right now, as we mentioned, Matt Dunn, Shap Smith, Sue Minter. Do you see a scenario where the Progressive Party decides to at least informally back one of them?
Well, that's a premature question at this point because we're so early in the cycle. I mean, we're still a year plus out from the actual election. And the other major factor is public financing. You cannot announce until February in the state of Vermont if you seek public financing. And honestly, with how much a gubernatorial and a lieutenant gubernatorial race cost these days, it's pretty hard for an average Vermonter to mount a viable campaign without seeking that adequate resource, that public financing resource. So it's premature for the progressives to know, first of all, if we have a candidate, because, again, we would think that one of our folks would actually seek public financing. So that's a February decision or piece of information. And then if that doesn't come together, I think at the earliest, May would be the time that we would be circling back and looking at the Democratic alternatives if there isn't a progressive.
So what does your sense tell you? At this point, do you think there will be a progressive candidate in the governor's race in 2016?
I think there's a strong likelihood. I think there's a strong likelihood, and it is my personal hope that we do, because as the state party chair, I am personally disappointed in the options that we have to right now so far. I think that Sue Minter is developing her platform, so we're sort of like yet to be seen where she stands on a lot of the core issues that progressives care about. Matt Dunn and Shap Smith have been elected before, and so we sort of know where they stand on issues, and they're pretty centrist. And I don't think that they are left enough for most progressives. But we will see where we are in May, and we'll see where all the options really are at that point, and we'll make a decision as a party.
Emma, you know there's some people who are listening who are thinking, if the progressives run a candidate for governor in 2016, and it's not a particularly well-known person, that candidate might get between 10 and 15% of the vote. And if that happens, it will almost ensure that the Republican candidate will win. How do you respond to that analysis?
Well, I think that the spoiler argument is actually one of the most undemocratic concepts that I've heard in all of my years of being involved in politics, because in a democracy, we should be having more options, not less. There shouldn't be kind of a dictation that you only can pick from two parties, and one being the Democrats and one from Republicans, because that's just very undemocratic. So I guess I would say that, you know, in the scenario where we would have an additional third or maybe even fourth person in the race, really, it's going to be up to the candidates to make the case to really win the votes. It's not about that's really what elections are about, is about winning the hearts and minds of a majority of Vermonters. It should not be about, hey, get out of the race because you might siphon off some of the votes that I would have gotten. You should earn those as the candidate. And I think the other reality is that when it comes to elections, if we look at 2014, there was no progressive in the race at that point. And the Democratic candidate, Peter Shumlin, barely won, barely pulled the votes together. So I think it goes back to what the focus should be about the candidate winning the votes on his or her own, and not so much on trying to edge people out of the race because they might potentially be more appealing to some of the electorate. That's the job of the candidate.
It seems like the progressives are taking a very serious look at the race for lieutenant governor, with the incumbent Phil Scott running for governor. That's now an open seat. Is it likely that we'll see a candidate there?
That one I can almost confidently say yes. And now that one is really about, again, coming back to public financing. It's a timeline issue and a legal issue about announcement. But I think our bench is growing and strengthening each cycle. And so I think we have a lot more options for lieutenant governor in a very serious capacity.
And how about trying to add to your numbers in the Vermont House and the Vermont Senate? How much is that going to be a priority in 2016?
That is going to be as equal, if you will, to our statewide efforts to elect a lieutenant governor or a governor who's a progressive. And mainly because we had success in 2014. We grew our bench by two. I know that's minimal numbers compared to other parties, but that is significant for a caucus that was, you know, 8 to 10 people in the Vermont House and Senate. So we will be focusing on that. We already are recruiting candidates for certain House and Senate races, and we're very excited. We have some very capable, competent, smart people who want to run as a progressive. And so we'll be seeing some exciting races around the state.
It'll be fascinating to see how all this works out. Emma Mulvaney-Stanek is the chairperson of the Vermont Progressive Party. Many thanks for being on the program today.
Of course. Thank you, Bob.
That is our program for today. Monday on Vermont Edition, very few drugs that are developed by pharmaceutical companies make it all the way through the testing process, and the data from the studies on drugs that don't make it are not made public. On Monday, we'll talk with a McGill University professor who thinks that information is still valuable and needs to be released. Send your questions to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and listen Monday at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Sengary and Sam Gale Rosen with production assistance from Hannah Kearns. Liam Connors directed the program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.